Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. In American society today, we like to enforce self-sufficiency, and people praise those that are quote-unquote independent. People say that the happiest people are those who don't care what others say as long as they have a very strong sense of self. Parents know that they succeeded in raising their children when they no longer need their parental support. We are quick to say that we shouldn't need other people to complete us. But today we have Amy Banks, author of Wired to Connect, to show us maybe there's a different way of seeing it. Maybe there's a way where you can have your cake and eat it too. A healthy relationship is the cake. Dr. Banks, welcome to the show, and thank you for your book.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
I've been doing this podcast for a number of years, and I will tell you that, for me, this is one of the most relevant books that I've ever read. For 39 years, I've been doing a fusion of neuroplasticity and executive life coaching. But you touch on some issues that are so relevant. I'm going to say that without understanding some of these principles, you're not really going to go anyplace. You mentioned boundaries. Yeah. Why are boundaries overrated?
Well, I start the book with that, and I have to say, you know, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek and purposefully provocative. But what I really want to be highlighting, and I think one of the concepts that really should be echoing throughout the book, is the idea that we are hardwired to connect, that we literally have these neural pathways for connection, right? The ways that we're able to connect in relationships with other people, literally there's a neurophysiology about that. However, we live in a culture that really tells us that the way to go is to be strong and independent, that sort of separation and individuation kind of mantra that I think is really so prevalent in Western cultures, and that in fact undermines these pathways and makes it even more difficult to have relationships. And when you think of that, like being strong and independent, standing on your own two feet, all of that goes hand in hand with having boundaries, these sort of impermeable walls between you and other people. And what I'm trying to say is, you know, we got to take down those boundaries, we've got to take down those walls, because what neurophysiology is telling us, neuroscience is telling us, is that we are interacting with people every single moment. There is no wall. And that, in fact, when we think of it as a wall and a boundary, that line you can't cross, we miss what is most important, which is that space in between two people where all the hard work of relationship happens. And that's where we really need to develop relational skills, not walls, right?
I agree, but I want to throw this out. Whenever I tell any of my clients how to understand your life, I say use two models. Use the anthropological model, where you came from, and use the molecular model, how you're built, how you're wired. So I'm from my perspective, the need for interconnecting is as primal as that, you know, we basically are tribal people, you know, and we acted as a tribe. And the greatest fear was not death. The greatest fear was to be thrown out of the tribe.
Exactly.
You know,
shunning, right?
You know, shunning. Yeah. Shunning was the greatest fear of all.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
Having said that, to counterbalance it, is that some people, they're in a very dysfunctional tribe, whether it's the parents or their relationships or their religion, and the necessity to get out and to be able to find your own voice, it doesn't mean that the person doesn't need other people to connect to, but it also doesn't mean that if you're in a horrible environment, you should stay there. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I totally agree with that. Yeah, so when I'm saying boundaries are overrated, I think there are places where, you know, I guess maybe the term I would use, but I think we're saying the exact same thing, is having a clarity about your own experience, your own internal experience, and also your experience in the relationship, and to be able to respond. And there certainly are going to be times that the response needs to be, I'm not going to participate in this kind of relationship, right? This is too abusive. This is too destructive to me. But to me, that can be a relational thing, not a walled up boundary. But
correct.
I totally agree.
I got a kick out of it because when you first put that question there, why are boundaries overrated? I thought to myself, well, that's what I tried to tell my girlfriend in third grade. Boundaries are overrated.
Yeah. But there you go. Right, it comes full circle.
And, it didn't fly then very much. But I want you to talk a little bit about the relationship in neuroscience. It's a fairly new field. I've been doing neuroplasticity for, over 30 years, but it is a fairly new field. Talk about it.
Yeah. So, the
way about the hardwiring.
About the
hardwiring in the brain, what helps us actually bond.
Yeah. So, as I was sitting down to kind of write this, what I thought was, how do you make this easy? And, you and I both know that once you start reducing neuroscience, you really do kind of distort it. But that being said, it's helpful to have some models. And so the way that I think of these pathways now is I use the CARE mnemonic acronym, whatever you want to call it, and CARE stands for these four neural pathways that I've identified that are crucial for connecting and developing, good, strong, healthy relationships. It also references, I think, the most seminal work that's being done in interpersonal neurobiology that really talks about this relational neuroscience. So shall I go quickly through each one of those?
Yeah, I want you to go through the CARE because I think that's really important. And I want you also to stress that some people don't understand the interaction between the frontal lobe or their rational mind and their emotional brain. And they also, when people are depressed, by definition, they don't see a way out. So in your going through it, I want you to also explain that there is a way out of any negative emotion or negative relationship.
So let me start there. I think the most hopeful thing that's come out of the field of neuroplasticity is that your brain can change, and also that thoughts impact pathways, neural pathways. Thoughts impact structure, right? So if you have a negative thought, that can be transformed, right? If you know sort of the rules of neuroplasticity, which we can get into in a minute. So let me put that on hold and just talk about the four pathways that I identify. The first one, so if we go through the CARE mnemonic, the first one is C, and that is a sense of calm that one can feel when you're in a healthy relationship, okay? And what that references is the work being done by Steve Porges out in University of Chicago, Illinois, along with a number of other people at this point. And what they discovered was that the autonomic nervous system, and I like to think of that as that automatic nervous system that's sort of running in the background 24/7, right, that helps you deal with the environment. And most of us who have taken a biology course have been steeped in the idea that there are two pathways of the autonomic, the sympathetic fight or flight response and the parasympathetic or the freeze response. And that's kind of how we deal. And what Porges has shown is that there is a third pathway. It's called the smart vagus nerve, and it innervates literally the muscles of facial expression, so you're around your mouth, your eyebrows, when you greet someone, usually there's a smile, your eyebrows get raised. It innervates those little teeny muscles in your inner ear that attach to those little teeny bones. And so when you are in a healthy relationship, you tune in differently. And it innervates your muscles in your throat for swallowing and also speaking. And what happens is, when you have a robust smart vagus nerve, when it's been developed in the context of healthy relationships, you can identify safe people. And in fact, what happens is when you engage, that literally the engagement stimulates the smart vagus nerve, which feeds back into your stress response system and actually helps you to de-stress or feel calm.
Right. Now, one of the things that I always tell my people, if you want to be a missionary, be a missionary, but don't marry the mission field, which means don't pick people to fix them. Because at that point, you're going to not have a good relationship. And then I would tie it into when we talk about a healthy relationship, it doesn't mean that you agree on all things. It absolutely means that you're incredibly comfortable that you're in a relationship where you're not judged for having your opinion, even if it's different. People underestimate the potential of their frontal lobe of their brain. I'm working with a person who's going to be going into the SEALs, and he is training right now where he could be in literally Arctic water for 4 or 5 hours, and his body temperature stays perfect.
It
requires some training, of course. But most people, when they say, "I can't," okay, they really mean I don't know how to, and they don't know the potential of their brain to change them. So take it away.
And the takeaway, are you wanting me to particularly address the frontal lobe to the affective centers? Is that
meaning, the question? In fact, address what advice you would give a person who feels limited in their ability to pick right.
Yes. Well, okay, so this is my advice. And the first thing is really having a sense of awareness of what your relational templates are, right? We develop this whole set of pathways, if you will, neural pathways within the context of our relationships. And so, and I think it's probably makes sense right now to just, you know, kind of zip into those rules of neuroplasticity, right? Use it or lose it, so that the more you stimulate a pathway, the stronger it gets. And neurons that wire together fire together, so that, you know, if two activities or thoughts or whatever are co-occurring, then they're going to develop into a neural network. And so relationally speaking, I think what you're talking about is, you know, those folks who find themselves again and again and again picking the very critical person that echoes maybe their mother or their father or, you know, some dynamic that happened in their family, that whole relational template, you know, of pairing up maybe love and family and closeness with criticism, right, then is literally programmed into these pathways. And you go out into the world, and that's what you're using.
And
right?
The point that I wanted to make, because what you've described is exactly what happens, that we use the pathways when we're born of everyone around us. All information is passed on to us. And what's most important for me, for our listenership, is that those pathways can be changed.
Absolutely.
If you work with a professional who knows what they're doing when it comes to changing neural pathways.
You got it. And so, and then the fix or the change, if you will, right, is building that awareness. Yes, with a professional. In my book, I have a relational awareness chart, and it really allows you to see these patterns. What do your relationships look like, right? Where are they not quite strong enough? Where are they, you know, where are you vulnerable, as well as getting kind of a snapshot of these pathways for connection? With that information, kind of that knowledge, right? And I think that's where, you know, you get to use the cognitive to, you know, to pause so that it doesn't feed immediately back into the affective system and get you reactive rather than responsive, right? So the awareness is first, and whether you do that with a professional or in, you know, a spiritual setting or whatever, that has to come first, right? You've got to get the cognitive engaged. You have to have a different template, at least cognitively, to be able to begin the change process.
Correct. Totally. You have to have a different template, and it is good to find someone who is, first of all, competent and who you trust. And I always make this analogy that how do you know the key is right for the drawer? It's because it goes in easy and it turns easy. If you have to to work too hard at it, it's the wrong key. Any relationship that says it's so much work, you know what? You're in the wrong relationship. Because having fun and building up trust is not a lot of work.
Although if we could come full circle to the point around, you know, what you don't want to do is give people the, you know, the false idea that relationships are no work, particularly if, for instance, and I take the area of conflict, because I think being able to manage, right, and do good conflict is probably the most crucial part.
I absolutely agree. And when I say no work, here's what I mean by that. I'm in practice for 39 years. I work literally 16, 17-hour days. I don't consider myself working. I have so much fun in what I do. It's so exciting and challenging and different that it's not – I don't get drained at the end of the day.
You're playing.
Yeah. So it's the same thing.
There's a freedom there.
Right. There's the same thing in a relationship. It's you know, the law of entropy. Energy always finds a lower level. Which the way I say it is, if you don't work on something, everything turns to shit. You know,
you just
have to work on it. But working on it doesn't mean fighting through it. It means dialoguing through it.
Yes, exactly. Yep. I think we're in total agreement there. Yeah. And one of the things, you know, getting back to the C and the calm, is if you think about then your autonomic nervous system as having these three components, right? Smart vagus, sympathetic and parasympathetic, having a robust smart vagus nerve actually allows some modulation of your stress response system when you're in those conflicts, right? So that you don't burst out into, you know, extreme anger or rage, or you don't totally withdraw, right? You don't bump into your parasympathetic nervous system and withdraw and not engage in the conflict, right?
So let me dumb it down a little bit. One of the things that, because a listening audience might not know all those concepts, what we're saying is that when you are properly wired and that you have a framework or a template of how you're to operate, you could work through problems without creating explosive or emotional, you know, I mean, you have to be within yourself, really self-aware, and there's a huge need for self-love and acceptance. That doesn't mean you don't have to continually mature, but you have to have a sense of self.
Yes. Absolutely.
Because so many people, you know, they're so sensitive because they don't have a sense of self.
You know?
And the people who are the most aggressive and the most obnoxious, they're really the most insecure, and, you know, they're fighting for survival. And they get off by making people feel bad, but they're really scared, like bullies.
Exactly, right? And they're operating, again, mostly out of their sympathetic nervous system, right? That stress response, that aggression, that anger, that whatever, rather than something that actually would allow them to negotiate and be in a healthy connection.
Talk to me a little bit. You're absolutely right, and I totally agree. Talk to me about parents, about kids who grow up with great parents, really communicative parents, and those who grow up with dysfunctional parents, which is most of the world.
Yeah, right, exactly, which is the most of us. So, you know, to say it's like black and white is maybe not even overestimating or overstating the problem. You know, the goal, so we're born with precursors to all of these neural pathways, right? We're born as these little infants that have literally reflexes to reach out, to connect, to suck, to, you know, coo, to attract, all of those things, right? And it literally takes a healthy adult to fully mature and develop as and interact with this infant to grow up, to mature these pathways, to get them coded accurately, right? I mean, essentially what a parent's job is on a neurological level is to create healthy neural networks, right? So that love, you know, both the word and the feeling and the sensation and then the action is all similar. It feels resonant, right? So love can be a hug. It can be holding. It can be a tender way of listening. It can be an acceptance. You know, all of that, that's the neural network of love, right? But when love gets paired up with the impatient parent, the screamer, the yeller, you know, all of then that becomes the neural network. And I think, you know, those kinds of, you know, of course, there's no ideal parent. All of us are battling our own little or not so little issues of how we were raised and kind of the culture that we were raised in. But, you know, the idea that that you would have a parent that would literally be participating in an active and intentional way in coding these networks is really a profound thought.
Yeah, it is a profound thought. And one of the reasons why we don't have it is because nothing is taught about parenting. One needs a license to cut hair or to fix a car, but one needs no skills whatsoever to bring a child into this world and learn how to create a healthy child. Because one of the problems is that parents want to make the children in their image so that they could have status. They want to brag about their child. They don't care if what their talent is. They care what other people think. And that's one of the big problems. And that, for me, is one of the reasons that some children begin to separate from their parents and then they find they can't bond to anyone.
Well, and think about it. I mean, that's part of the bind that I talked about in the beginning of this conversation, which is we live in a culture that actually doesn't value relationship, right? We value status, we value consumerism, we value getting to the top of the heap, right? You know, and I'm not anti-capitalist, but capitalism makes money. It doesn't necessarily make healthy relational templates, right? And so that hyper-competitive message, right? The parents are in that, and you know, in their minds, without having any awareness of this dynamic, in their minds, they're doing the right thing by preparing their children. This is even before we get into, you know, abusive parents, but preparing their children to be able to compete in this, you know, hyper-competitive system, right? And that, unfortunately, usually is in opposition to very, you know, very deep, sophisticated relational skills that are needed to negotiate in the workplace, you know, at school. And so I think we are, all of us, most of us, left, you know, somewhat stilted in our ability to make connection.
But you know what happens, and I agree with you, in many companies or even school, like in law school versus medical school, you know, you're really, everyone you're competing against, and it's hard sometimes to build relationships. But I do want to say that I think capitalism is catching on, because companies like Google and Apple, where they're continually creating bonding experiences, communication experiences. So I think this new generation of entrepreneurs are getting it right.
I totally agree. I think you're absolutely right. It's not capitalism in and of itself. It's how it's done,
it's
right?
How it's done. Exactly.
In a power over way, right? Rather than in a power with way. Because, you know, the truth is, when you can harness the power of relationship, whether it's the way, you know, some of the practices Google has or some other, I think, really, really progressive education systems, then you really can see that it can be a win-win. Right.
Absolutely. It absolutely can be and should be a win-win.
It should be.
And if you become a professional, you can make it a win-win with your clients. But this is why I love your book so much. What you're literally telling people is that you need to remember that we are a human race before we're anything else, before we're Americans and French
and
so on and so forth. And if we don't operate on a human level, and the second we dehumanize a person by stigmatizing them, then we lose some of our humanity, and that creates a huge problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. You have cracks and rifts in the social fabric everywhere, right? And that breeds distrust, and that stimulates the sympathetic nervous system, right? And then you're back to, you know, chronic stress and ill health.
Talk a little bit about the need for dopamine, what it is, how it functions, and how we get it or don't get it in our daily life.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm going to go back to that care model, right? So we started C was for the sense of calm you get when you have a robust, smart vagus nerve that can sort of buffer the stress response system. A and R we'll skip over, and we'll go to E on the care program, and that is a sense of energy that you that most people will get when they're in good, healthy connection. And that is directly related to just what you're naming, the dopamine. And so in the beginning, again, if you take that proverbial infant that's trying to grow in the world, the dopamine reward system is literally paired with things that are good for you, right? So nurturance, hugging, you know, being held, water, food, healthy food, all of those things get paired with the dopamine reward system so that something that is healthy for you, like that, actually gives you a hit of dopamine, right, which causes a good feeling, gives you more energy, literally more energy to act, to be in the world, to do what you want to do. And so ideally, in a world that sort of keeps relationships central and keeps this idea that we're part of a tribe central, that pathway, that dopamine reward system, and just as an aside, I mean, I think, the dopamine reward system stays connected to healthy relationship. And so one of the things that I really highlight in the book is when you are really teaching kids to be hyper-independent, that, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, or they have been in abusive relationships as children, what happens is you begin to take dopamine out of that equation. And people need energy, they need motivation, they need dopamine, quite literally, in this dopamine reward system. And I think this is one of the things that we're seeing in our culture, that you kind of decouple relationship and dopamine, healthy relationship and dopamine, and people are looking for dopamine elsewhere.
Correct.
And all of the addictions.
And that was the point I was making, meaning there are two things that become very problematic. One is the overcompensating parent, who's maybe very wealthy and has no time, and you just throw money at the kid, their dopamine levels are going to go down because you're not challenging them to live life. And the opposite end of the coin is those who don't have that dopamine use drugs, cocaine, crack, whatever, in order to stimulate the dopamine, and that is sheer disaster. So dopamine is very, very important, but it has to also be coupled with the, you know, making life fun in its challenge.
Like, you got it.
Nothing is a problem. You just have to work it through.
That's right. Playing, right?
Playing.
Just
absolutely.
The notion of playing, just safe play, stimulates dopamine, whether you're an adult or a child. But the key is real play and safety.
It's funny because you just reminded me of a client that I had, and she was quite intelligent, but I explained to her, because she had this low level depression, is that we need to kind of stimulate your dopamine. She says, "I am married to a dope. I don't need my dopamine stimulated."
That's correct.
So
therein lies the problem, right?
Exactly, exactly. Therein lies the lack of dopamine.
Exactly. Right. Right. That's funny.
Talk to me about, can children be healthy in a relationship where there are two mommies or two daddies and it's a non-traditional relationship?
Oh, you know, I hope so because I have 17-year-old twins that I'm raising in a two-mom family. So first of all, I have to, you know, by way of bias, I have to say, yes, it can happen. I also have, have been part of something called the Longitudinal Lesbian Mother Study, actually, that has studied a group of over 100 two-mom families over the past 25 years. And so I think literally, scientifically, the answer is without a doubt. And in fact, one of the things that you find in these families, now, you know, it's a bind, because you know there's always the risk, and certainly has been, you know, 20 years ago, the risk that the kids will become ostracized or shunned for being different or being from a different family. On the other side, there is an intentionality that you see in families, two-mom families, two-dad families, an intentionality of love and acceptance that I think is actually a gift to children. And I think that you know, by and large, that comes through. I
mean,
you think about
my
the
personal experience is that people who are in a two mom or two dad families, that they work harder to communicate, to nurture, and to nurture one another, and that the kids tend to be so much more open, you know, to everyone else, and they come out really smart, you know, and really well adjusted.
Yeah.
So that's my experience.
Yeah. And I think it does translate from, you know, starting for the parents, really starting life in that outsider position, right? Starting in that outsider position, and I think having an appreciation maybe of what real vulnerability feels like. And, you know, I think that if you can be in touch with that as a parent, right? It's hard to do because, of course, you've got these little beings running around that you know, are like attached to your heart. But if you can have an awareness of your vulnerability, I think you can see it in your kids and kind of be present with it differently.
Yeah, and I'm going to just clarify this. You know, it is always, always, always about two healthy people. You know,
exactly.
Whether they're,
absolutely.
You know, but I don't care who they are. If you are a healthy person and you have the understanding that this child wasn't born as a slave to do your bidding, but was born as a gift to find out who they are and help them become that, if you're healthy, it doesn't matter who you are, what any orientation you are, because it's about being healthy.
That's right. And what an infant or a child needs is lots of grown-up healthy individuals. That's what they need to shape their brains and their bodies, literally.
Yeah, absolutely. And the ability to be exposed to different things and to realize that there's a point of view. You know, there's a point of view that everyone has based upon their own experience, and just don't reject it as not being true. It could be not true for you, but it doesn't mean it's not true for everyone. Like, I like chocolate ice cream, and I'm not crazy about vanilla. Is that a fact? Well, that's my fact. Not everybody else's fact.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That kind of, that real cognitive flexibility, but it's also about, right, growing the pathways that allow you to see another person clearly, right, and not be threatened by it, right? You know, and when, you know, there's a woman, Jean Baker Miller, who was a psychiatrist and a mentor of mine, who came up with this concept, the five good things in a growth-fostering relationship. And I'm going to just name them quickly because I think it's helpful for people to think about what is a healthy relationship, right? And what she said, you'll know it because you have these five things. Number one, you have more energy, kind of that sense of zest. You have more clarity about yourself, the other person, and the relationship. You feel a greater sense of value of yourself and, again, the other person. You have a desire to connect beyond the relationship, and you have more ability to act within the relationship, right? And sort of thinking about that, that idea of clarity about yourself and that somebody else doesn't have to be just like you, right?
In fact, it's so important sometimes that they're not. Meaning, I to get a little personal, my wife, my first wife, we met at 17 and we were together 30 years, and then she died of breast cancer.
As we
had the choice, my younger daughter came to me and said, "Dad, I found this school that if I can make it, can I go?" And it was in Montreal, it was in Canada. And what it was a school that had about 500 kids from 172 different nations. And literally changed her life. She, you know, she first of all came away with five languages, but she makes friends with everyone. I mean, she's you know, a white kid living in Harlem, and she's the only white kid on the block, and everyone knows her.
She is
the kid. So, really do think that when we properly teach our children the difference between stereotyping and looking at behavior, okay, rather than putting a label on it, we really help them grow very confidently.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think you might be familiar with the studies that actually have looked at, you know, kids, you know, early on, and when you're, it's sort of, there's a natural sort of just a screening in our bodies to notice difference and be both curious but a little bit anxious. And as you get exposed to more difference, of course, that dissipates. And difference is, you know, there can be vast differences that no longer feel different.
Exactly.
Right?
Because
I think that's what you're
100% because
about.
What happens is now change becomes something exciting rather than something nerve-wracking.
That's right.
You know?
I mean,
and
she's wired like all of these other cultures and, you know, perspectives and all of that. And no doubt it was exciting and fun and, right, all of that gets wired together, which is really wonderful.
No, I mean, absolutely. And my older daughters, in case they're listening, I got to throw in her. They're Leanne and Melissa. She taught herself Chinese at 15, at 18, she was teaching in Nanjing University, English to Chinese. So being in that environment, you know, was incredibly rewarding for her. And she also has a million different groups of friends.
Yes.
Now, let me ask this question.
Okay.
Tell me about the need for people. There are some people who really cherish their alone time and their silent time, and I'm one of those people, and I am the ultimate extrovert. But I like sometimes to just shut off and everyone just, you know.
Yes. So I think it's a great question, right? And, you know, the concept of connection isn't that you have to have somebody attached at your hip, right, 24/7. One of the things that happens when you have a network, which it sounds like you do, whether it's, you know, your partner, your friends, your children, when you have a network that really feeds these four pathways for connection and keep them alive and robust, those relationships live within you, right? So that a lot of people, you know, downtime is downtime. You know, you can have alone time. And so, you know, the question I would send back to you is, or maybe not a question, but a statement, is the idea that it's different. If you're well connected, alone time can be peaceful and relaxing and recharging. If you're totally disconnected and don't have people in your life, alone time can often feel lonely, right? Isolating, kind of scary. And so when these pathways of connection are robust and you have a rich network, you're not alone even when you're alone. Do you know what I mean?
Correct. You're not alone even when you're alone because, you know, being alone means there's a detachment and there's a fear of being hurt. But if you're contemplative and you're kind of doing something that's, you know, whether it's reading or praying or meditating or whatever the case might be, you're not alone. You, in fact, are trying to connect to some other things.
So I completely agree. Yeah. And people often ask about, you know, what about introverts versus extroverts? And, you know, I say a similar thing, which is, it's about the quality of people around you. It's not about the volume, right? And that's one of the ironies of the Facebook phenomenon, right? Is you can have, you know, 3,000 friends and no connections, right? You know, so it's the quality of the connections.
I'm so happy you brought that up.
The
electronic world, the Facebook, the Twitter, this does not make human connections. It's very interpersonal. You know what? You need to talk and you need to meet and you need to gather around and break bread and you need to be able to do things together to really be able to feel safe and to bond. Because
we're
living in a world where relationships are so poorly formed because everything goes the easy way of electronics.
Exactly. And I mean, it's such a setup, right? Number one, we have a culture that says, stand on your own two feet, then we don't teach social skills, then we then we sort of throw this electronic media and say, this is how you get friends, right? I mean, it's a setup for more and more disconnection. And ultimately, I think it's going to be a setup for more and more illness, quite literally, in our entire population.
Good.
That being said, the other thing I do think happens, and I'd be curious about your thoughts about this, is that if you're the kid, and this is something I learned firsthand from my daughter. If you're the kid that is doing those things, having the conversations, going out for coffee, right? You know, playing on the sports team, really interacting in groups, you know, wide network of friends, then actually those connections, the little selfie, the storyline that's coming through are little punctuations of positivity.
And I completely agree. Meaning, yeah, if it is an addendum to a healthy communication,
yeah,
it's great.
Exactly.
Okay, it's just,
yeah,
like if emotional intimacy, you know,
yes,
is built first, then sexual intimacy is great. But
yes,
don't
exactly
try to build the sex before you build the emotion.
Yes.
You know,
yes,
so
exactly.
I completely agree. You know, for parents out there, you need to make sure that you are evolved, and you need to realize that you don't own this child. You're there to do the best you can, and if you don't know how to do that, then that's where you seek out a professional.
Exactly.
Dr. Banks, you are such a pleasure to have, and you're a wealth of knowledge, and I really appreciate you being on the program. It was great to have you.
Oh, thank you. You know what? Thank you so much. This really was just a fun and playful conversation, right?
Yeah.
As it should be.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a character, so I always play. So it's, you know, I like to break the rules. But you know what? Yeah. At the end of the day, the rule is, if you could see the value in another human being and you could understand that they, just the way everyone has their own DNA, their own fingerprint, their own tongue print, their own toe print, their own iris print,
exactly,
that each one is an individual, and stop putting labels on people and start enjoying them, you know, and working with them, that, you know what, the world doesn't have to be the way it is. It can change, but it can't change without communication.
Yep. Well said. Well said.
Well, you have a beautiful weekend, okay? I heard where you are. I just heard the news. It's going to be 85 and sunny. Okay.
Yeah, right.
And you're going to get a nice tan, and tell your family, coming from Dr. Gluck, that they are so lucky to have you, and vice versa.
I will tell my 17-year-olds that, and you know just what they're going to say back, right?
Oh, yeah, I do.
And that's just okay. You have a great day, okay?
You too now. Bye.
All right.
Amy, thank you so much for joining us today in the studio. It really was a great session, and you are just a great speaker. Everybody, pick up a copy of her book, Wired to Connect, online at Amazon.com or your local Barnes & Noble bookstores, as long as they're still there. Also, you could find more information about her book on TatchaBooks.com. I am Errol Gluck, and I want you to remember, there is a solution to every problem. Please check out our other episodes. We are taking on sponsors. This particular show was sponsored by Platinum Pois, where power couples are put together, profiled. It is the end of online dating into actually being matched up by professional profiling to who is going to be the perfect power person in your life to get the most out of it. Visit my website on glucksolutions.org. You are really going to want to check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com and our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/GluckRadio. You're going to visit my website, glucksolutions.com, and you're going to like us on Facebook. Get people to listening to the show. There is something for everyone. And you will learn how clinical hypnosis coupled with life coaching will change your life quickly and permanently. Thanks for listening. Until next time.